It's always an honor and a pleasure to visit the KITP, and so I would like to thank the KITP staff for their excellent job hosting us, and also I'd like to thank the organizers for organizing the meeting, and in particular for putting me as the next talk after Ruslan, because this was a very nice talk that you just gave, and it means that I can go much more quickly over some essential points. Please feel free to stop me at any point. I went through the talk this morning and kind of eliminated a number of slides so that in anticipation of a similar amount of discussion as the previous talks had. So if you need more clarification on some point, let me know. I have other slides and number of points. So I assume that you're all experts on NICTIDES, but maybe not experts on penetration depth, although you have heard certainly several penetration depth talks. So I want to just introduce a few essential points so that we're all on the same page. The penetration depth, of course, is a measure of a superfluid. These are the coefficients that people were asking about at the end of the last talk. We, like others in the field, when we measure the penetration depth, we tend to report the superfluid density and just 1 over the measured penetration depth in nanometer squared, without making any attempt to put this prefactor in order to normalize it to the more physically perhaps interesting quantity. Only a few techniques can measure the absolute value, lambda or lambda zero, of the penetration depth, and most of those techniques average over the sample or the sample surface. They measure the response of the entire sample. So usually people think of the superfluid as being determined by the gap structure and therefore as being a measure of the gap structure, and of course to really famous examples are the nodal superconductivity in yttrium barium copper oxide. This is the change in the penetration depth in units of angstroms as a function of the temperature, and you can see it's nicely linear. And then this is the normalized superfluid density as a function of temperature. And here is what a weak coupling BCS, a single full gap, would look like. And here's what D-wave looks like. And so there's 2 points that I want to make here. The first is that not only the power law of this slope, but also the magnitude of the slope is very important for determining whether you have nodes or some other source of a power law. And the second point that I want to make here is that in order to plot this normalized plot, you of course need to actually know the zero temperature value of the superfluid density. And here they plot error bars for what's actually a very tight range of systematic error bars around the possible variation of what that zero temperature value is. Okay, so another example is this is just a cartoon of a two-gap superconductor, and this is magnesium diboride, the classic two-gap superconductor, and you see that only down here, really at very low temperature, you see something that looks kind of flat, even though it has a full gap, and you know the one gap isn't really all that much smaller than the other gap. Okay, so in addition to measuring the gap structure, the temperature dependence of the penetration depth is sensitive to scattering, phase fluctuations, and to the loss of carriers to competing order parameters. There's been quite a work, there's been some really nice work on penetration depth that's specific to the NICTIDES or that was motivated by the NICTIDES. I'm not going to have time to synthesize or review that. In fact, when I show our data, I'm going to try to concentrate on the main phenomenological features that we observe and not really discuss relationship with specific theories that much. But I want to make a couple of points. One is that the different materials can have different gap symmetries, and in particular, there's this hypothesis that different states are nearly degenerate, and so there could be various switches, including NICTIGEN height. And then impurity scattering can alter the intrinsic behavior in interesting ways. If you have an intrinsic nodal superconductor, impurity scattering can lift the nodes. And if you have intrinsic nodeless S plus minus, then scattering can give you a power law superfluid density. Okay, so general questions that we want to look at in the NICTIDES. What is the order parameter? To my view, neutron scattering and quasi-particle interference seem to indicate pretty strong evidence at the smoking gun level for S plus minus in at least some materials, but we'd all like to know whether there are important further details around that hypothesis or whether there's significant variation across materials, and I think there are still some holdouts who aren't fully convinced that those are full smoking gun signatures. Second question, when we started this, we thought phase fluctuations might be important, probably not. How does the neighboring magnetic phase impact the superconductivity? And is inhomogeneity or sample variability present? And if so, why? So there's this low temperature variation of the superfluid density, power law variation of the superfluid density is observed in many penetration depth measurements, as we just saw. And when we started looking at this, we thought that perhaps in an Emery and Kivelson sense, that the absolute value of the penetration depth might support the hypothesis that phase fluctuations were really important in determining the low temperature power law behavior. And if you just take the superfluid density, take the penetration depth measurement numbers that people measure and put them into Emery and Kibelson's formulas, it doesn't really look like that's a dominant effect. It's not orders of magnitude away, but it seems to be one order of magnitude away. The absolute value of the penetration depth suggests that the energy cost of phase fluctuations is sufficiently high that phase fluctuations are probably not an important factor in the low temperature behavior of the penetration depth. You need to know several parameters. They all have quite a bit of variability on them, and that's why I say probably not instead of no. Yeah. I'm perfectly happy to have somebody else do that calculation and reach a different conclusion. Yeah. Okay. So for our work, I want to tell you about local measurements of the penetration depth in iron nictide superconductors. This is the view from the window of my student Len Luan. And I have a postdoc opening in my group, and so, yeah. Okay, so collaborators and funding. Of course, we benefit tremendously from our collaborators who make samples, especially in recent years, the Ian Fisher group down the hall from us. And the experiments that I'll show you today were done by Lan Luan, Cliff Hicks, Tom Lippman, and Bina Kalifsky. So the basic idea is that we use the local diamagnetism as a measure of the penetration depth. And we have two main techniques that we use. One is magnetic force microscopy. In this technique, we have a sharp tip, which is coated with magnetic material. We bring it close to the surface of the sample, and we measure the force gradient of the repulsive force between the tip and the sample. There could also be a small additional repulsive or attractive force from the presence of any vortices. We're not going to use vortex imaging in order to extract the penetration depth. That's also possible in principle, but in our experience, using vortex imaging to extract the penetration depth is subject to systematic errors on how well you know the shape of the tip and the shape of the magnetic coating on the tip, that we're not prepared to use that to give real numbers, although within systematic errors, it's consistent with the numbers I will be giving you. The main point is that when you look at the repulsive force between the tip and the superconductor, the repulsive force is equal in the limit that the height is large compared to the penetration depth to the force that you would get from a mirrored tip, but not that's mirrored around the surface, one that's mirrored around a mirror plane that's a penetration depth below the surface. And this means that you can make measurements of the temperature dependence of the penetration depth without knowing anything about the structure of your tip at all. You simply make a measurement, and then you change the temperature, and you see how much the force changes. And when you change the temperature, the only thing that changes is the penetration depth. So essentially, this mirror plane shifts up and down. Okay, so height measurements tell you the change. So measurements as a function of height tell you the change in the penetration depth in a model in a way that doesn't depend on your model. By modeling the tip, we can also extract the absolute value of the penetration depth. Our other technique is scanning squid cell septometry. We have a squid with a 3-micron pickup loop. So this is a different length scale than this, where the tip has about a 30-nanometer radius of curvature in some cases. We have a 3-micron pickup loop. We measure the flux through that pickup loop. We also have a field coil. We apply a current through this field coil. And again, the field at the location of the pickup loop is equal to the field from the current in the field coil plus the field from the sample. And the field from the sample is that of an image field coil that is whose distance is about a mirror plane that's a penetration depth below the surface. Does anybody have another pointer? This pointer is running out of battery. No? Okay. Oh, wait, here's one. Yeah, there's a stick. I like sticks. Yeah. Okay, great. Excellent. Okay. So that's the main technique, and in order to have plenty of time for discussion, I have several more slides on the technique. If you want to see them, please ask. The main points here is that the local measurement lets you observe local variations and check sample homogeneity at no additional cost, but there's an additional cost. There's a big cost for making a local measurement in the first place. It's very time consuming. So this is both an advantage and a disadvantage. The advantage is if there's variation, you can see it. The disadvantage is if you only measure one place, you only know what the penetration depth is at that one place that you measure. You don't know the penetration depth over the whole sample. So the best thing is that the sample average measurements and the local measurements will agree with each other. And I think that that's really important. It lets you avoid artifacts from the edges or topography simply by avoiding them. And if the sample surface is parallel to the crystal axis, you avoid mixing of lambda C and lambda AB completely. Okay. So let me give you some examples of fairly homogeneous samples. So our spatial resolution is actually effectively limited by our height. In the case of the tip, we move the tip sometimes closer than 50 nanometers to the surface, and then the spatial resolution is limited by the curvature of the tip and by the averaging over the tip geometry. And in the case of the squid, we're averaging over regions of several microns. So here we're averaging over regions of several microns. Here we're averaging over regions as small as 100 nanometers or so. Between these two. In principle, it could be. Yeah. They agree nicely, so yeah. Okay, so this is an example of a fairly homogeneous sample here. We started a scan height of a micron. This is with the magnetic force microscope tip. Here's an image of three vortices. And now I'm going to lower the height. And as I lower the height, you see the vortices get sharper. Here I am at 63 nanometers, and you see three vortices. And they all look pretty similar. So the first thing is that those three vortices look pretty similar. And the second thing is that the background level, the shade of blue in the background, is pretty uniform. So that means the force gradient isn't varying with the lateral position. And those two things are both some indication of homogeneity in the penetration depth. So the diameter of these spots that we present is determined by some combination of the tip profile, the height, and the shape of the vortex. So in principle, you can actually use vortices with small penetration depths to measure the effective point spread function of the tip at a given height, and then go back to other superconductors with longer penetration depths and measure that. And there has been some other groups that have done work on kind of modeling the tips. We've also done some work on modeling the tips. And this is, you know, these images are consistent with the expected profile of our tip. But we don't feel confident to extract the penetration depth from that deconvolution with more than 50% error bars. It's good, though, for seeing variation in the penetration depth, because this peak height is determined from, you can determine it from modeling the vortex as a monopole that's a penetration depth below the surface. And so actually, this peak height is very sensitive to what that penetration depth is. So the uniformity of the peak height is a, yeah. Yeah. Right. You can do better than the monopole model, yeah. I was just trying to use a monopole model to indicate why the peak height is a good measure. Yeah. For this image, we're clearly in the limit where the intervortex distance is much larger than the penetration depth, and that's because these things look like isolated objects. So this is actually a very low field. These vortices are like 2 microns apart from each other. Nobody thinks that the penetration depth could possibly be that big, so that's another confirmation that we're in that limit. I can show you data probably privately later as a function of increasing vortex density where we ultimately start to lose contrast. Right, exactly. Once you get to the regime where vortices are closer than penetration depth, or actually closer than your height, whichever comes first, you lose contrast very rapidly. Yeah. Yeah, 0.3, but yeah. roughly. Okay. So here's another example of characterizing the uniformity of a sample. This is a Lefepo single crystal. Indeed, when you measure the bulk diamagnetic susceptibility of this, you see about a half a Kelvin transition width on a 6 Kelvin sample. That's considered a pretty good sample. If I show you the transition, you feel like it's a sharp transition. So by imaging, look over here, there's some topography, but now I'm imaging the local diamagnetic susceptibility. So I have a squid, I'm applying a local magnetic field, I'm measuring the local diamagnetic screening, okay? And this is vacuum. And the color scale is the mutual inductance between our field coil and our pickup loop, whose value is modified by the presence of the diamagnetic screening from the sample. So this is vacuum, and this is half a Kelvin, this is 5 Kelvin, doesn't look very different. And now as we go from 5 Kelvin to 6.5 Kelvin, pay attention not only to how the image changes, but also how the scale bar changes. So you see that you start to lose some superconductivity in the sample. By 6 Kelvin, this height has, this scale has changed quite a bit. And by 6.5 Kelvin, essentially most of the diamagnetic screening is gone, but you can see that there are still some regions that still maintain a little bit of residual diamagnetic screening. And then you can use that to plot the local TC of the sample as a function of position. Okay, so we consider that a pretty homogeneous sample. In what we would call pretty inhomogeneous samples, you would have regions where you would lose screening well below what's the nominal bulk TC. Okay. So here's some examples of less homogeneous samples. So this is some underdoped YBCO imaged at various TCs as determined by how the oxygen is annealed. So when we start with the oxygen not having had very much time to find its preferred place at room temperature, we see that there's just some magnetometry. There's some sort of fractional vortices that we associate with vortices moving around near the surface. That's a whole other talk. And it kind of gets better as you give the sample more time to anneal. Here's an example where this is actually hundreds of microns, and you see a lot of individual nice-looking vortices whose apparent size is resolution limited by the size of our squid pickup loop. We cooled it in a pretty small field. And then here you see this big patch of stuff, and actually if you look at the local magnetic susceptibility here, you see that this patch is just not superconducting. Even at a tenth of TC, there's just a big non-superconducting patch there in the middle of the sample. And then here's another one where we didn't know this was a good sample. I mean, it looked really nice in the bulk susceptibility curve. We cooled down, we had no idea what this feature was. And then we looked at the bulk susceptibility and we found that most of the sample was just not superconducting at all. And whatever this edge is, there was just a ton of diamagnetic susceptibility on this edge. Don't know what's going on there. Yeah. Oh, you mean, yeah, along this line? Yeah, good question. Yeah, I can show you afterwards a lot of images of vortex positions, and we can try to tease that together where there's some linear correlations or not. I keep thinking that there are, so yeah. The other thing that you see there is vortex pairing, but that's also a different talk. Okay. So here's another example of a not perfectly homogeneous sample. This is a p-doped superconductor. This is the, so if you just look at this susceptibility scan, it looks pretty okay. There's not that much variation in the susceptibility across the surface of the sample. But if you measure the low temperature penetration depth at these three different spots, this is delta lambda in nanometers versus temperature in Kelvin, location one, location two, location three, you see very different slopes at those three different spots. Okay. So now I want to tell you some results from local measurements on the penetration depth in nictides, and these are the three things that I want to talk about: Lefepo, twin boundaries, and cobalt-doped 122, and then measurements of cobalt-doped 122 that span the superconducting dome. So first, Lefepo. This work is from the PhD thesis of Cliff Hicks, who's now in Andy McKenzie's group. And the basic result is that looking at two different samples, with four different locations on one sample and one location on a different sample, we see a linear temperature dependence of the penetration depth. This is delta lambda versus temperature for three different samples. It's really quite linear. And if you fit it to a power law that's not perfectly linear, then the best fits are sort of cluster around that linear range, I would say. The slopes at these different locations agree very well. It's about 140 angstroms per Kelvin, or 143 plus or minus 15 angstroms per Kelvin, looking at the different locations and including the systematic error bars from our measurement. And if you look at this in terms of a normalized superfluid density, these are three different curves for three different possible values of lambda zero, which we don't know. And so those curves are a little bit different, but they basically all have this pretty robust linear slope down at low temperature. For comparison, we show a YBCO with a breadth that indicates the uncertainty and the known penetration depth of YBCO. And you can basically see that both of these have the common feature that, you know, there's a very robust, significant linear temperature dependence of the penetration depth at low temperature. And that indicates that the nodes are well formed. Okay, I'm not saying that it's D-wave, but the point is that the nodes have some kind of structure like this, not some kind of structure like this, which wouldn't give you the same power law. And if you have a favorite gap function, we can check whether it's consistent with this. Yes. Well, actually no, because if you have something like this, you're going to be moving through this gap in the relevant temperature range. Yeah. Yeah. So this. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Sure. No, our lambdas are not varying by a factor of two from one sample to the next. Right, exactly. No, that's really important. This is our raw data. This is delta lambda. These are our five different values for lambda zero at 4 points on one sample and 1 point on another sample. Our d lambda dt is not varying from one sample to the next. Yeah. These samples have the same TC, yeah. We also measured a sample with a different TC, which we can talk about privately. Okay, so the other point that I want to make here is that the superfluid density rises sharply just below TC. So this is YBCO. I don't have a weak coupling BCS on here, but basically whatever your guess is for the low temperature lambda zero, like this is just coming up pretty quickly near TC. Okay, and so, yeah. This point. Right. Right. It depends on what the relative weight of the two Fermi surfaces is. So, well, let's say they're roughly the same. So, you know, it's going to depend a little bit on details, but, you know, this is saying that you kind of need to have a node on the dominant Fermi surface. And then if you want to give me... No, power law wins, but the point is that, I know, Zlatko, you want me to move on, but actually this is, yeah. Oh, okay. So power law certainly wins over exponential, but the point that I want to make here is that if you have a preferred gap function, then you can just fit it with a two-gap model. And if you have half the carriers and something that has four nodes, then you're going to have half of the slope that you would have if you had all of the carriers having that many nodes. And it's pretty hard. You have to make pretty strange assumptions about lambda zero to get to that point. So I can't tell you for sure that that's not happening, but if you tell me what you think the gap function is, we can fit it and check. Yeah. Okay. So just another way to say that, I think we've beaten this one pretty well, but another way to say that is that a really high fraction of the carriers, half or more, are on something that's seeing nodes. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. You're just counting the ones that drop out of the condensate. Sure, absolutely. But you have a lot that are, but even that, you know, the strength of the slope tells you that a lot are dropping out of the condensate. That's all. The magnitude of the slope tells you that a lot are dropping out of the condensate. Okay. Okay. Yeah, no, that's not an artifact. That's real in our samples.
So why do you call
that? Because I'm talking about the comparison between. I'm talking about this part here.
So there's a shock leaking, but the MTC.
There's also a little tail in these samples. Yes. Yes. Okay, so again, this is our same data. The linear slope was widely known. I think the linear slope in LaFeppa was widely known. The main point that I want to emphasize here is that rho S also rises sharply below TC. And also I want to point out that the Carrington group also sees delta lambda linear in LaFeppa, but they see a slope that varies between samples, and they also see a very different overall temperature dependence. So one of the things I would like to take away from this workshop is how to think a little bit more about what's going on in this intermediate temperature region. So here again, here's weak coupling BCS. Here's what we see with different assumptions or guesses for lambda zero. Again, I emphasize all of our samples look the same. That's not different samples. And these are what the Carrington group sees on two different samples. So you can see that it's a very different overall temperature dependence than what we see, as well as the fact that they see different slopes and we only see one slope wherever we look. So in LaFeppa, it's a little hard with our current equipment, so in principle, yes. But the thing is that even if we do that, it's not going to change the main features that I point out here on this slide. Yeah. Okay, so my two slides for LaFeppa took a little longer than I was thinking, so I may go a little faster. So, okay, thanks. So I want to tell you about the enhanced superfluid density on twin boundaries of cobalt dip 122, and this is the work of Bina Kaliski and John Kirtley. And so here is the main result. Here is a slightly underdoped sample of cobalt dip 122, and it was x equals 5.1% with a TC of 18 Kelvin. And if we look above TC and the magnetic susceptibility, we don't see any systematic features. We see a scratch here because we've come down close to the surface specifically to see stuff like that. Here we see the same scratch. Just below TC, we see a slightly patchy onset of superconductivity, which is quite common. That's the model background. And then we see these white stripes, like very clear, robust white stripes. And here they are again at 17.5 Kelvin. And the total enhancement at 17 Kelvin is comparable to the bulk diamagnetism. And it's about 2% of the bulk diamagnetism at 5 Kelvin. That's, I want to make sure this is clear. That's, our signal is 2% of the bulk diamagnetism, but since what we mostly see in this sample is very, very good screening, that means that we see even better screening that's quite significant on the location of the twin boundaries. Yeah, I can. So, and this sample was the sample where we had the largest separation. And so we used this sample for most of the modeling because this is a sample where in our imaging limit, the twin boundaries are well separated. On most, we looked at seven different samples in this study. On four of them, we saw these effects, all of the underdoped ones, as you know, we saw these effects, optimally doped and overdoped, we didn't. And the twin density variation that we saw ranged from below our spatial resolution up to this much, with it being typically several to 10 microns in most regions. Absolutely consistent, yeah, with what you guys had previously seen. So that was actually the fact that you had seen them was really important for us in identifying what this was. Okay, so here are some indications that this really is enhanced superfluid density on the twin boundary. And roughly speaking, if you ask me why, I don't know why. And here are some speculations for why it may be. And since our chair has given me 10 minutes, I want to go on. The other thing that I'll mention here. Yes. Right, absolutely. So there's a couple things there. The first thing is that in conventional superconductors, it's known that on twin boundaries of elemental superconductors, it's known from bulk diamagnetism screening that there's a different TC on the twin boundaries, right? And it just comes, as you said, from a local phonon mode. So it could be that there's something like that going on here. We actually don't see anything above TC, which is kind of interesting in a whole other conversation. But there's a lot of other things going on our twin boundaries. So I think it's at least worth thinking about whether in the nictides there's a similar mechanism operating or whether it may come from other strain effects or from frustrated magnetism. The other thing is that in YBCO there's also a lot of conversation about twin boundaries that I didn't do justice to here. Yeah. Okay. So also, the other thing I'll mention is that this enhanced diamagnetic susceptibility repels the vortices, and I'll be happy to talk more about that after. Okay. So let me talk about cobalt dope 122. So the motivation to make these measurements was, as Ruslan pointed out before, the early literature showed different results from different groups on similar samples. For underdoped samples, we know that the superfluid density is very different on twin boundaries, which suggests the value of a local measurement rather than a sample average measurement. And also, we see that across the dome, the vortex pinning landscape is not at all homogeneous. The vortex size is homogeneous. And again, I can show you that data separately. But where the vortices sit is not homogeneous, not an underdoped, not an overdoped. So this is our main result. This is the systematic evolution of rho S. So this is the superfluid density in units of 1 over micron squared for different dopings. Most underdoped, 4.5%. Next most underdoped, 4.9%. Next most underdoped, 5.1%. Optimally doped at 7%, overdoped at 8.5%, and then more overdoped at 11%. And then this comes from superimposing magnetic force microscopy and scanning squid measurements to get the full temperature range. And then this is the low temperature variation, delta lambda as a function of temperature for four of the samples. Okay, so let me go relatively quickly now through the main trends that we see. First of all, at optimal doping, we see full single gap behavior. This is a fit to a phenomenological. There are some issues by what you mean when you say phenomenological fit, as Ruslan just nicely pointed out, but this is one fit to a phenomenological single gap model, and I think it's a pretty okay fit, and it gives us a delta over KTC of 2. Yes. So this is the low temperature delta lambda for the optimally doped sample. And this is in units of nanometers. And so I'm going to call this pretty flat. I'm going to call this, pretty flat, really pretty flat. Okay, so actually I think that's a pretty important point. Like this is really pretty flat, scientifically speaking. Okay. So the others are not, and so as you go away from optimal doping, you have a little bit of temperature dependence here. And so you can fit that in a couple different ways. You can actually fit it with two full gaps, with a small second gap that accounts for the finite delta lambda. If you do that, those are the best fit gap values across the dome. I wouldn't take those too seriously. The main point is we see a little bit of temperature dependence at low temperatures. We can fit it with two gaps. Okay. That's right. Yeah. You can either take account of the coupling in a reasonable way, or you can fix the TC to be the same. We took the minimum number of parameters, so we fixed TC to be the same, which is. We haven't done Ruslan's level of detail of the fit, but I'm pretty confident it would also give us a good fit to a two-gap model. Yeah, slightly different. The low temperature behavior you can also fit to a power law fit. So delta lambda equals AT to the N. So here is A. Again, this is all at a much smaller scale than the plot Ruslan showed you, right? So here A is really pretty zero at optimal doping. And then here's the best fit power law for this data set. It ranged from like 2.3 to 2.7. But actually with error bars, that includes 2.5 for all of them. Okay. The next point I want to make is that, again, about this, what happens close to TC. So rho S rises sharply below TC for the underdoped and optimally doped. So here, this is the normalized rho S. And here I show it for the red triangles are 5.1%, that's slightly underdoped. The blue squares are 7%, that's optimally doped. The yellowish-greenish chartreuse, I guess you call it, 11%, that's overdoped. Compared to like YBCO and MGB2. And you can see that it really rises pretty sharply near TC. So generally, people fit that with this phenomenological model that has this parameter A that characterizes how quickly the rise is below TC. So it's 1 for weakly coupled BCS, and it's 1.7 for the underdoped and the optimally doped cobalt-1D2. OK, so once the superconductivity turns on, boom, a lot of carriers join the party very quickly. Right. So actually, the first part of that, I was going to have an interpretation discussion in my talk at the end. And the first part of that, I mentioned that and was planning also to reference you guys on. And then the second point about whether it's consistent, whether we can somehow do a fit that forces delta over TC to be large enough is something that we could probably talk more about. I hadn't really appreciated that. Yeah. OK. So the last phenomenological point I want to make is that on the underdope side, the rho S is reduced strongly. So this is lambda 0. This is rho S. And this is optimally doped. So it really doesn't change very much with doping on the overdope side. These error bars go from 200 to 300. And then here on the underdope side, it goes up. And so it just goes up much more quickly here than it does there. Goes down. The rho S goes down much more quickly here than it does there. Okay. Okay, so then the last phenomenological point that I want to make is about the homogeneity checks that we've done on these samples. So these are the samples that we measured. We actually measured 2 4.9% samples. This is how many we measured with the MFM. This is how many we measured with scanning squid substoptometry. We could resolve vortices in all of them, but this one, the sample appeared pretty uniform in squid substoptometry for these. There were actually some non-uniformities in the squid substoptometry for these samples. And then here in these four samples, we saw that the delta lambda of T measured at different locations at different points on the sample was the same. And for this one sample, at 11%, we saw that it wasn't. So here we measured three different locations, position 1, position 2, position 3, that were separated by a couple hundred microns. And these are the three different delta lambda slopes that we saw there. And actually, that variation is much larger than could possibly be explained by cobalt variation. We checked cobalt variation with some different local characterization techniques. OK, so I was supposed to stop. But the main point that I wanted to make is that there's a number of different features that evolve with doping. But all of the main things that we see, I think, can be qualitatively explained in terms of some interplay between magnetism and superconductivity. But since I'm out of time, there's one more thing I want to talk about before I stop. Yeah, OK. So these are our main three features: fast reduction of rho S for underdoping, sharp rise of rho S near TC for some samples, and increasing delta lambda magnitude at low temperature away from optimal doping. And these are generally consistent with strong relationship between superconductivity and magnetism. But I want to say something else, too. I want to say something about what it means to measure the penetration depth in samples that have this low level of doping. So this is a complete change of gears from everything I've been talking about up until now. So suppose that you have variation where you have 5% cobalt doping. in something with the nictide structure. Okay, then you can take a, this is just a silly toy model to indicate the effect. We have some measured TC versus X. And on this side of the dome, so this is around 4% cobalt doping, and this is around 7% cobalt doping. So suppose you take a model where you give each unit cell 0, 1, or 2 cobalts with Poisson statistics. Okay? Then suppose that you average over a coherence volume to get some kind of local doping. The local doping that you get from that kind of model, because the coherence volume is very small, and because the number of cobalts is also very small, this local doping is going to be significant, unless there's some other way to do the averaging other than to average over a coherence volume. You're going to have little nanometer regions that go from like this effective local TC to this effective local TC, all on the same sample. And this is no criticism of the sample growers at all. This is just assuming that you have perfectly random, you know, statistics for 4% chance of having a cobalt on any given iron site. Okay, so then you can do something that's a little silly, but suppose you just assign a penetration depth that's based on the TC associated with the local doping, and then you average the local penetration depth or superfluid density. If you do that, then this would be a delta lambda versus temperature for a uniform BCS delta lambda of a given doping. And this would be what delta lambda would look like averaged over the stoichiometry landscape that you get from doing a calculation like this. Okay, I'm not saying that's the right model. I'm saying this is a motivation to figure out what's the right model. Okay, so wait, Ruslan, just sorry. I'm over time, so I'm just going to say these are my main conclusions, and thank you very much. Yeah. Right, so nothing in that model gives you a dome, but the argument is that if you knew the right way to do the averaging of those properties, then you would have to do some kind of self-consistent model. Like, let's say you had a model that gave you TC as a function of local doping, right? Then you would start with some microscopic model for what that should be, and then if you had some way to do the averaging, then you would do that averaging to figure out what your actual measured TC as a function of your actual average doping would be. Yeah, but you would, in either case, you need the dome to start with. Yeah. So I think, if I could also answer the question, yeah. Thanks. What I would like to do, and we can maybe do it right afterwards, is I would like to take your data for optimally doped and put it on top of our data for optimally doped. And then I think that would be a good way to do it. And then we can set some kind of upper limit on the, I mean, we think of this as being an upper limit on power law behavior, if you like. We could see if that's the same. I agree we both see like pretty small, we're both consistent with pretty small slopes. Yeah. 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 Right. So trying to do a proper model of what I was showing, effective mass, variation in effective masses would be a reasonable thing to put in. Yeah, so, yeah. Wait. Let me just say, I claim that due to our geometry, we are measuring lambda AB exclusively here. So certainly measuring lambda C would be an important other thing to do. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Intentionally refreshing to see our workshop organizers breaking their own rules. So now I will bring this part of the session to a close. Organizers want to make an announcement.
While everybody's here, let's talk about two things.